Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode here at The Damage Report, still under lockdown with something like 96 days to go until the election and about 2 years until the end of the pandemic, so we've got a lot of stuff on the horizon for you. It's an exciting show, but not necessarily the show you were expecting. Today is Wednesday, that's true, and Wednesday remains a big news day, and we certainly have that. But I did see one comment on YouTube from someone saying that they're looking forward to TYT's Captain America and Black Panther doing the show. Look, according to this commenter, we have Captain America, but Jordan Yule, which hero are you?
Oh, what a setup. That's not prepared. Sorry, I'm not.
Who do you associate with? Like, who's your guy or gal? Either way.
Oh, man. I don't know. I see. This is something I don't bring up frequently because mm-hmm. it's just the reaction I get from a lot of people is always like kind of a knee-jerk one. I'm not really into superheroes. Never seen any of the Avengers. I don't watch the Marvel movies.
You've never seen any of the Marvel movies?
No, they just don't. I mean, I saw one of the Spider-Mans. It's just they've never really been interesting.
Was Tobey Maguire in it?
No, I saw one of the new
ones. Oh, okay. Those are good.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, you know, don't feel bound by Marvel. Well, we're going to give you some time. Through the course of this show, if there is a hero that you think of, feel free. Maybe like the president from Independence Day, you know, or something.
There
like
we
that.
Go.
There yeah. you go. Anyway, okay. Well, in any event, we're glad to have you. Okay. Jordan Yule stepping in. JRE is going to be on the show. That's tomorrow. Captain Super Nightman suggests Ant-Man, but you haven't seen Ant-Man, so we're not going to stick you with that. But anyway, very lucky to have Jordan here, not only to give his perspective on the news, but at the close of the show to give his perspective on a story that I don't think I'm leaping ahead of myself in saying is the result of Jordan's reporting, and I can't wait to talk about it. So that's at the end of the show. Before we get to that, though, we've got a lot on coronavirus. I want to sort of catch up with a little bit of the international research that's been done over the past few weeks, the past month or so. We've learned a little bit about some of the lingering effects after one recovers from coronavirus, as well as more information about the propensity for kids to spread coronavirus. So we're going to have all of that. We've got Portland-like tactics in New York City now, and a lot more besides. If you are already in the chat, as close to 3,000 of you are, please hit the like button, share the stream and all of that, and you can chat along. We'll be responding to your tweets and Twitch comments and super chats and all of that. With that said, you want to jump into it?
Let's do it.
Let's go. Avengers Assemble. That's a reference you don't get.
I don't.
You don't? Okay. Donald Trump is finally starting to show that he is being emotionally affected by the ongoing pandemic, and he has some empathy for once in a video we're going to show you. Unfortunately, he feels bad for himself and has empathy for himself.
He's got a very good approval rating, and I like that. It's good. Because remember, he's working for this administration. He's working with us, John. We could have gotten other people. We could have gotten somebody else. It didn't have to be Dr. Fauci. He's working with our administration. And for the most part, we've done pretty much what he and others, Dr. Birx and others who are terrific, recommended. And he's got this high approval rating. So why don't I have a high approval rating with respect and the administration with respect to the virus? We should have a very high. So it sort of is curious. A man works for us, with us very closely, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, also highly thought of, and yet they're highly thought of, but nobody likes me. It can only be my personality, that's all.
Well, it's certainly not helping, but I don't think it's only that. Jordan, so he's sort of making the case there that because Dr. Fauci is so, and I love that there's a cat crawling over your head right now in the video, because Dr. Fauci has a really good approval rating, he is very happy about that. And then he starts talking about how I didn't have to have him, I could have had anybody, I'm really happy for him though. But anyway, and then talks about how he should be getting some of the credit. Now, I assume the Dr. Fauci stuff for me has sometimes lapsed into weird hero worship that I think is kind of unnecessary. But what do you think about the people's different view of the advice of like Dr. Fauci and then the overall government response?
I mean, this seems to be like he's upset that the ratings are different, but like, this all boils down to him openly contradicting Fauci, not really explicitly heeding his advice. Family members, like Trump's family members, have posted things even as recently as earlier this week contradicting like pretty base, like standard CDC claims about like coronavirus prevention, wearing a mask. This is like they're pushing conspiracy theories. But Trump seems to think just that he's like associated with him and that Fauci is still at the CDC, that he too should be seen in such noble regard. But you look at how Trump has responded to this crisis overall. You look at now how deaths are piling up and how we are leading the world in number of infections and deaths. It's a complete and total disaster. We're the laughingstock of the world. That's why people don't approve of the job he's doing and really wish Fauci was kind of at the helm in, on this front.
Yeah, I don't like people, if they like Fauci, the reason, like part of the reason they like Fauci is because Trump doesn't like Fauci. I think that that's part of it. I think people, I don't know that a lot of people would consciously recognize that, but I think that's part of it. I get a kick out of the fact that this guy works in the Trump administration. Trump absolutely despises him. That's some schadenfreude that I need in 2020. But if they like him in terms of what he has said and done, they believe that he actually follows the science and will give advice that largely reflects that. That doesn't mean that that's what the government has done. And Trump can't now whine saying, well, if you like Fauci, you should like me, when we're in like week whatever of his war against Fauci, dispatching his surrogates and all of that to, you know, basically create Oppo research reports on Fauci and to continually claim that he was wrong or misled people early on. But anyway, look, that's the personality stuff. He's obviously so jealous. In terms of the substance, though, if he actually was going to be driven by just wanting people to approve of him, then he should change what he's been doing, because as of July 28th, more than 4 million cases have been confirmed just in the United States. There have been more than 150,000 deaths. There were 1,144 deaths reported just yesterday. We're back above 1,000 for multiple days now, close to a week. And in terms of his approach, you can't pretend that you're Fauci when just two Sundays ago, you were still calling testing overrated. And right now, your goons are negotiating with the Senate and saying that there should be less money for testing and tracing. There should be no overarching government response. All of that. Your rhetoric is horrendous and uncaring and ineffective. Your leadership is totally absent. And when the Senate tries to do your job for you, you try to step in to stop it. It's not about throwing a pitch. It's about the effect you've had on the pandemic, and yours has been abysmal.
Yeah, I think you summed it up perfectly. This is deeply rooted jealousy from Trump, because it's not really about performance. It's about, as we've seen so many times before in his presidency, it's about media coverage. It's about like kind of like a pop culture aesthetic. Like he just wants to be like the Kennedy type president where everyone fanfares over him, but like his own incompetence gets in the way, and just like, now his own like narcissism is impacting how he responds to a global pandemic. It's absolutely incredible that we're in this moment. And even still, I mean, I know there's really no floor for congressional Republicans, but even still, that they're kind of going along with this bogus hoax narrative. It just to some respect, not you saw people aren't wearing masks in Congress. It's flabbergasting. I have no idea what the future has in store for us, because I feel like it could only get worse now.
Yeah. I mean, like, he's like, what? Come on, Fauci's great. Just look at me like Fauci. Yesterday, he was retweeting the demon semen woman saying that COVID has a cure. No, but like, but if it has a cure, then why hasn't Trump used it? The whole thing, like, I guess I'm glad that their new conspiracy theory is at least based on saying that the coronavirus is real. That's a step up. Unfortunately, they think that you get it by having sex with witches that aren't real. They're mind witches. I don't know. Yeah, that may be part of it. It's not just your personality, Trump, although that's certainly not helping. Literally anything, least of all yourself.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Let's talk about Representative Louie Gohmert, one of the absolute goobers of the House. Louie Gohmert does not take this pandemic very seriously, and he has not from the very beginning. He told CNN last month that he was not wearing a mask because he was being tested regularly for the coronavirus. Now, this is after, by the way, already representatives, it's a huge list, a bunch of them, mostly Republicans, one Democrat, had already tested positive for the virus alongside Senator Rand Paul. So he was fully aware that despite the fact that all of them were getting tested, some of his colleagues were coming down with it. And, like with Rand Paul, potentially spreading it to other people before their relatively persistent testing actually picked up on it. You might remember that back March 9th, he returned to Congress despite potentially being exposed to the coronavirus at CPAC, saying he's advised by the CDC that going into self-quarantine isn't necessary. Yeah, I'm sure that's what they told him. So, look, he just didn't take it seriously, and perhaps it's because he was fairly convinced this entire time that he had the solution. It was a powder that might have been involved with hydroxychloroquine. It wasn't really clear when he talked about it, but he said it's being used in Germany as a mist. Healthcare workers go through a misting tent going to the hospital, and it kills the coronavirus completely dead. Not only right then, but anytime in the next 14 days that the virus touches anything that's been sprayed, it's killed. You'll be shocked to find out that's all nonsense. But it was reassuring to Louie Gohmert, and it might explain why Manu Raju, reporter, said, "I've spent a lot of time in the House gallery watching Gohmert frequently interact with colleagues and not wearing a mask. He doesn't maintain social distance and talks at length with members. When I asked Gohmert, he said he would wear a mask if he got COVID." So look, all of this irresponsibility and then that pledge means that you know exactly where this story is going. Representative Louie Gohmert is tested positive for the coronavirus, according to multiple sources. Because of course he's going to. He's a moron who doesn't care about his own health or the health of people around him, and he runs around talking about dust mist. What do you think, Jordan? You shocked?
No. And yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. I don't know if I want to laugh or just cry or what, because I mean, it's sure, it's ironic that he got it. It's kind of funny. It's, you don't really feel bad for him because he knew the risks. He was in a position to know way ahead of everybody else. Congress knew at the onset, and he took no precautions. And his ignorance also impacted how he responded. Him and congressional Republicans have treated this as a complete joke. And we've seen everything from just a delayed response to an inadequate response in different relief bills, wanting to cut unemployment benefits, and now they're trying to push money toward the defense industry, toward weapons and F-35s.
Yeah.
When people are struggling. So it's like this guy kind of got his comeuppance, but I don't think he'll even learn. That's the thing. I think he'll just, because he's going to have great healthcare treatment, which is something that millions of people around the country don't have. He's going to be fine, probably. Right.
Yeah, he'll probably be fine, as all of them are. And of course, I want him to be. You know, hate him. I've hated him for a long time. I don't want him to be sick, and I don't want him to spread it to other people that are not in charge of how irresponsible he is. I have someone that I know that is in a very bad way thanks to coronavirus. My heart goes out to literally anyone who's going through that, including Louie Gohmert's family that's probably very worried about his health and probably was worried about his behavior prior to him getting it. But anyway, as you said, now is the time for him to change his behavior because finally it has actually happened to him. And as Manu Raju said, he said that if he gets it, he's going to wear a mask. He's going to be more responsible. But if you watch his channel, you probably know where this is going. According to Catherine Fowler's, Representative Gohmert went back to his Capitol Hill office after testing positive for COVID-19 at the White House. The question now is, where does he quarantine? Probably at work, Because I doubt he's going to take it any more seriously now than he was, because as soon as he finally was diagnosed with, again, a fatal illness, he went back to work. How many people work at his office? I don't know. Hopefully none were in the office at that time, but probably some were. Hopefully they're taking it more seriously. The entire thing is just so sad. I was talking to my mom yesterday, and she was talking about how shocked she was at how selfish everyone was being. That she walks around Florida, and even after this huge spike, nobody wears masks. And I said that my theory has always been that we all have a circle that has to be breached before we take things seriously. And that circle is a different size for different people. For some people, it's the size of the world. If something happens somewhere in the world, you're going to have empathy for those people. It doesn't matter how dissimilar they are from you. And then for a lot of people, the circle just gets progressively smaller. It could be the country, or it can be your race, or your religion, or your neighborhood, or whatever. For some people, it is smaller than their own body. That even when they directly experience this, that is not enough to actually get through to them and cause them to change their behavior. We are too selfish of a country, too, you know, enthralled with our own independence and feigned greatness for us to learn, for too many of us to learn anyway. And that is sort of sad in the best of times. And we are far from the best of times right now. And his sort of behavior writ large across a gigantic percentage of the American population is why we continue to have the problems with this pandemic that we do.
Yeah, I know. I think that even though it's a small anecdote, it's demonstrative of his kind of larger worldview. Going back to his office, just carelessly, like putting his staff at risk, kind of shows how he sees and treats people beneath him. There were people, you might not have seen it, but there was another report that there were people in his office who were scrambling to get out before he got there because they didn't want to get it. Some people, sadly, were still there, and probably as he's treated every other interaction, he just didn't take any precautions. Yeah. So he now has put his staff in jeopardy. He's been at the Capitol Hill gym, I saw reported this morning, since contracting it. And yesterday, he was with Bill Barr. They were before the hearing or after the hearing. They were like in close proximity.
Let's keep that going. That's fine. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah, he was in the and the Republicans at the hearing yesterday were like complaining that Nadler was telling them to wear masks. Dude, you guys were being exposed right then.
Yep.
And like, you know, I think my wife told me that I think the was it the wife or the mother of the Long Beach mayor? The mom passed away. Like, there have been so many representatives, senators who've lost people. Elizabeth Warren had a relative who died. Maxine Waters had a relative that have died. Our representatives have generally been okay, shockingly. They've done very well, and no one in the White House has died, but lots of people have gotten sick, and some of their family members have died, and it's still not enough to get through to these people. Like, you think Louis Gohmert's going to be much more responsible, speak more responsibly about it, tell his constituents to wear masks? I really doubt it. Many, many people here in the U.S. and internationally have died as a result of coronavirus. A lot more have, of course, survived the illness, but that does not mean that they get off scot-free, that they're going to be perfectly fine and back to great health. And I want to show you the results of a couple of different studies indicating one form that these lingering effects can come in. The first is a German study that examined the cardiac MRIs of 100 people who had recovered from COVID-19 and compared them to heart images from 100 people who were similar but not infected with the virus. More than 2 months later, infected patients were more likely to have troubling cardiac signs than people in the control group, with 78 patients showing structural changes to their hearts, 76 having evidence of a biomarker signaling cardiac injury typically found after a heart attack, and 60 having signs of inflammation. Now bear in mind, these were relatively young people, average age 49. These are not 70, 80-year-olds. They were healthy before they fell ill in the spring. Many of them have just returned from ski vacations, so they were active exercisers as well. None of them thought they had anything wrong with their hearts, and it's likely, although we can't say for sure, that prior to getting coronavirus, they did not. But after getting it and getting past the virus, they had some of the same signs of heart damage that come from having a heart attack, despite the fact that they had not actually had one. So we're going to have another study, but Jordan, we've been hearing about, you know, the organ damage that comes as a result of having coronavirus. I had mostly thought that it was lung damage, but now we're finding out that the heart can also be negatively impacted as well.
Yeah, this is scary. And the more we learn about it, the scarier it gets. And just as we get more and more research, and we find out more of the consequences and long-term health consequences of this virus, it seems like it's like running parallel with how dangerous and reckless governments are acting, which is kind of scary because like now we're at a point where like people are just like so desperate to reopen to save small businesses or whatever. It comes at a time when we're finding out that it's even worse than we had originally imagined. So I hope that people take this to heart and spread this kind of research and findings to warn their officials about these about the risks. I don't think it'll have an impact, sadly. I'm sorry to be a downer, but just like business interests seem to reign supreme throughout this entire thing. And it's even to the point where we're going to have like mass evictions and people just don't seem to care. I mean, what's people having heart attacks, you know, or heart damage as a result? They're not going to care.
Yeah. We've been trying to raise awareness. We did yesterday and the day before about the eviction crisis. And unfortunately, look, I'm going to keep it real. Even, you know, on a channel like this, where I have to assume our audience is more predisposed to be interested in those sorts of things, neither of those videos did very well. Either the overall numbers, the racial inequality that's going to come in the eviction crisis, people just aren't as tapped in or as interested. And that's unfortunate. We got comments, by the way, from on YouTube. Siv Harkin says, I still have triple vision and sore throat and fatigue from the virus from March. God. That's brain inflammation, and I'm nervous about clots. We've certainly heard about that. There was also Swin Sassy says, I still don't have my stamina back and fatigue, and I had it in March as well. We're seeing other comments to that effect. So, yeah, you do continue to see these effects. We have one other study, though. There's another German study which analyzed autopsy results from 39 people who died early in the pandemic and whose average age was 85, found high levels of the virus in the hearts of 24 patients. And we have a comment from Matthew Tomey, cardiologist and assistant professor of medicine, who said, patients come to my office saying, hey, I'm a 31-year-old who used to run and be completely unlimited in my exercise, and now I get palpitations walking across the street, or I get out of breath climbing up to my second-floor apartment. Individuals are exquisitely tuned into their own capacity for exercise, so I take that very seriously. Our challenge is to understand the why. And look, I get, if you're Donald Trump and, you know, you're trying to get people to not think about the fact that so many people have died, you're going to say things like, and he has many times, you know, the vast majority of people recover, and that is true. And perhaps the vast majority of those people won't have these horrific long-term effects, but many of them will. And we're talking about, if there's 4 million cases, how many tens or hundreds of thousands of people, in the end, when we finally get past this pandemic, are going to have ongoing lung damage or heart damage? Think about the cost to them in dealing with these lifelong issues. And then, again, writ large across the country, think about how that's going to affect America, not just until fall or next year, but for the rest of their lives, for literally decades, we're going to be affected by this. And so, again, this is not a thing where, hey, it only kills a small percentage, so let's just get everybody infected and then get it over with, you know, at the same time. No, think about the havoc that is going to be wrought on the people who survive it from that strategy. And many people in positions of authority still think that's the way to go. It's not, and we're seeing more and more evidence to that point.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what it's going to take for people to care. It's just a complete and total disregard for human life. And people, you know, seen as just kind of subhuman or just cogs in a machine. Yeah. I that's really startling what you said earlier about the homelessness and the kind of like the whether it registered for people. I think it's just because it's so existential and it's so big that people cannot comprehend the severity. I think that might be what it is. And we're a society that kind of has been cultivated and groomed around this idea of instant gratification through different services that we've now like expedited through shipping and deliveries and social media giving you immediate dopamine hits and that kind of stuff, that now we see so much instant gratification and we correlate that, we extrapolate from that and assume everything is has an instant remedy.
Yeah.
And while this is like not going away, people can't really comprehend that in mass, and our leaders especially don't. I think they know deep down how bad this is, but here we are. We're now adding another consequence to this, and they do not care. The people are going to be. Where are they going to go when they lose their homes? What are they going to do when they have this heart damage for years? Our healthcare system's already broken. We don't have a living wage. People, and we have millions of people who lost their healthcare as a result of the job losses from this pandemic. Yeah. What are they expecting this to look like in like 5 months?
Yeah, yeah. And when you say they, like obviously, you know, Trump and the governors and things like that. They don't give a damn. They've made this as bad as they possibly can. But they're not the only people in they. Like, as we're seeing this, and we're trying to figure out what is this going to look like in a year, in 10 years, in 40 years, the DNC just had their platform, and they don't support Medicare for All, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of all of their voters say that's the policy they want. They're not only giving the middle finger to all of the people who are already being affected health-wise from the pandemic, as well as the country at large, which would massively benefit from that policy change, but their own base, which has been yelling at them for literally years now that they need to move in this direction, and they're still saying no. It not only lost, it lost overwhelmingly. Yeah, and so there's a lot of people who are setting up a situation that is going to be devastating for a lot of people for a lot of years. Schools are set to reopen. Many will be doing distance learning, but unfortunately many will not. And many kids will be going back in and associating with each other, hopefully with safety, you know, precautions put in place, but for many of them, perhaps not. And we have been told along the way that this is not a concern because kids don't spread coronavirus, which isn't a good enough response because kids are not only the only people in schools, but let's say that they were. Let's say that we were just concerned about kids spreading it. Well, we're finding out a little bit more thanks to a South Korean study, a massive study involving tens of thousands of kids. Here is what we know based on that. Children under 10 were roughly half as likely as adults to spread the virus to others, consistent with prior studies. That may be because children generally exhale less air, and therefore less virus-laden air, or because they exhale that air closer to the ground, making it less likely that adults would breathe it in. Look, that overall, not bad news, although them being half as likely makes me only half as concerned. It's not 1%, and it's not being sold to us, by the way, as kids just being half as likely when, you know, our politicians are talking about it. But sure. Now, even so, other studies have suggested that the large number of contacts for school children who interact with dozens of others for a good part of the day may cancel out their smaller risk of infecting others. Okay, so that is for less than 10. They're half as likely, but that might, you know, be washed away by the fact that they have terrible hygiene and they interact with everyone. The issue is that for kids who are in middle and high school, that group is even more likely to infect others than adults were, according to the South Korean study. Some experts say that that finding may be a fluke or may stem from the children's behaviors. Look, if it's a fluke, then fine. We don't have to be worried. If it stems from other children's behaviors, then I don't really care what the cause is. If it turns out that kids above the age of 10 are more likely than adults to spread it. And there, we're not talking about just high school seniors, we're talking about most of school. How many students fit into that group of being in 7th grade, 8th grade, and high school, Jordan? That is millions of people who we find out are not, you know, superhumanly protected from spreading the virus. They're actually more likely than you or I are to.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was a moment early on where there was a study circulated that showed like 1-2% of kids are going to die as a result of schools reopening prematurely. And that was just kind of passed along on Fox as like, well, you know what? But, you know, this is just kind of a necessary evil. I'm sorry. 1-2% of kids in schools are going to die. And you're just like, okay with it. But now we see the consequences as in terms of spreading and prolonging this virus, which will lead to more deaths. And this really shows that this type of, like, this view and this style of governance, especially from the right, has never been about pro-life. It's never been about protecting children or protecting the life of a child, because here they are willingly and deliberately putting kids in unsafe situations, and then the consequences, a prolonged virus, people will die. It, absolutely grotesque.
Yeah. And it's happening now. I saw kids today on Twitter, photos of them, you know, like wearing their little masks on the, you know, the yellow school bus. And I just think, like,
so grim.
What are they? First of all, it's 100% grim. But then also, like, you know, I love kids, but what do you think those kids are going to keep those masks on the whole time? They're not going to touch each other. Look, first of all, having the masks in general, probably a good change for schools because kids spread disease every single day in schools. But it's not going to be enough. Teachers are going to get it. Teachers are going to die. I saw a photo of a teacher with a sign holding up saying, I can't teach from the grave. Like, this grim situation. We are all, we have been, if the virus, like, if I could snap my fingers and the virus went away, this was an absolute debacle, a tragedy, a disaster, the likes of which we've never had in America during my life. If it ended today. But it isn't going to end today. Today, they're going to report that more than 1,000 more people died. And they're setting up situations that seem maximally designed to spread the virus. And now, through new vectors, through kids, We're going to send all the kids back in. They're going to spread it to each other. They're going to come back. They're going to spread it to their families. And their family members who have to go to work are then going to spread it to other people. This is, I can't think of a thing you could do other than maybe telling people not to wear masks that would be more likely to cause more people to be infected and eventually hospitalized and die as a result of this. It's an absolute disaster. Misinformation is all over the internet when it comes to coronavirus, especially this week with that new group of doctors getting millions of views on the video that Breitbart put on Facebook. And look, the sum total of things like that and the Plandemic video and the misinformation on Fox News has left a lot of Americans believing absurd things about coronavirus. Let's talk about one in particular, some polling. Was coronavirus planned by the government? That somebody, we don't know exactly who, but somebody planned for this pandemic and unleashed it on us. Well, 5% of all Americans believe that that is definitely true. 1 out of 5 Americans believes that it's probably true that the government planned this pandemic. That's 25% of the American public. 1 in 4 believe it's either definitely or probably true. Only 36% say it's probably not true or definitely not true. A lot of Americans just don't really have a position on that. That is 1 in 4 Americans believe that no, it was planned. It was planned. We're gonna break this down along a few other different demographic axes, but what do you think, Jordan?
It's alarming, and it shows kind of how people getting their news from social media and the lack of kind of moderation and content curation on these platforms leads to this kind of stuff. People just want to believe this because it helps explain something that's so grandiose and so existential that, you know, it helps them make sense of something that is otherwise incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. That's sad because the end result is distrust and skepticism toward, and as it manifests, it's distrust and skepticism toward health professionals. They think that they're out to get them. There's distrust of doctors. And the end result is this is prolonged. It impacts people and the health consequences we talked about in the earlier segment. More of that. More death, more illness, more job loss, more homelessness. Absolutely terrible. But I can't help but, again, reiterate that huge tech giants and social media platforms that are knowingly allowing this content to spread is so reckless. Yeah. They know what's on there. They know what spreads in Facebook groups, and Facebook just is taking a hands-off approach because they don't want to be like the arbiter of you know, truth and information. But, like, that's your responsibility. You're one of the biggest companies in the world and people get their news from you. You have to do that. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, Facebook eventually took down that video, but it already accrued more than 10 million views. And they said today, you know, sorry, it took a while. There was like this thing that happened that made it take longer. Was there? As it got millions of views? How many videos get millions of views every day? You didn't notice that? So they took it down, but they also left it up for a while. And one theory as to why it was left up for so long was because it was being spread by Breitbart, a group that has been whitelisted by Facebook as a purveyor of accurate news. They have done this multiple times. So here's the thing. That information was, according to Facebook, was both false and dangerous. It could lead to people getting sick and dying. So if Breitbart is spreading that, are they, you know, an accurate source for news? Are you just going to take down this one video, or are you going to view Breitbart in a different way? Perhaps have a little bit more oversight of future videos that they put up to try to mislead people about this pandemic. Unfortunately, we know what Facebook is, we know who Zuckerberg is, and we know that that's never going to happen. He believes Breitbart's more reputable than New York Times plus the Washington Post plus whatever you want. And that means that you had Plandemic, and then you had this, which is even bigger, and God only knows what's going to come next after, you know, 200,000 or 250,000 people have died. They'll come up with some new thing about how it's secretly frogs that are spreading the coronavirus, and you only have to consume a frog, and then you'll be okay. I don't know. It's hard to predict. It's hard to get ahead of how crazy people are. By the way,
yeah.
On this, a few more numbers on how it breaks down that people think that this is centrally planned. Interestingly, and I would not have predicted this, women are more likely to believe. 29% of women believe it was planned by powerful people. 21% of men. Shocked by that. In terms of age, younger people more likely than older people to believe it. Even though, in my experience, older people believe whatever crazy thing you tell them on Facebook. No hate for the older. It's just generally I've seen that. What's interesting to me, too, is when you break it down by party, 18% of Democrats, of those who lead Democrats, Democrat believe that it was centrally planned, 18%. For Republicans, it's 34%. So they're twice as likely to believe that this was centrally planned, despite the fact that their people are in charge of government. I have to assume when they answer this, they mean the Chinese. If I had to guess, yeah, that's what it would be.
Yeah.
Maybe the deep state.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of also why we've seen kind of like a reluctance from even the media entities like Sinclair that was considering running that plandemic hoax video. Like, it's just like part of a larger like American capitalist scheme to undermine the Chinese government. So that fits their narrative, even if the consequences are, you know, Americans putting their own lives and others around them at risk. The end goal, the end objective is that, you know, like the conclusion that you pointed out, people would take that away as saying China did all this to hurt us. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a xenophobic and anti-China objective.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's been fascinating since Trump got elected that, like, this movement, which has been obviously is government is the most evil thing imaginable. Government is the source of all of your problems. And then all of a sudden, hey, we control all of government. And I wondered as they were making that transition, like, well, then how, man, they're really going to have to change how they view this and how they talk about this. But they haven't. They've just invented other layers of government to hate. It's not the government we see, it's the deep one below it. That's actually what has all of the power. It's great that you can be complete insiders and still present yourself as total outsiders as you control every branch of government effectively. For many weeks now, we've been talking about what's going on in Portland as Donald Trump has sent in his goons, which are maybe some cops, maybe some soldiers, maybe some mercenaries. We don't really know. Isn't America great? And they've been brutalizing people, and we've been showing you those videos. Well, they are now being dispatched to other cities, and that is going to cause all sorts of new problems. We're going to show you a video, though, from New York City that is not actually Trump's goons, although you could be forgiven for not at first realizing it. Here is the NYPD arresting an activist. Okay, so that apparently just happened, by the way, in New York City, and I want to give credit, by the way, to Michelle LaHook, who apparently took that video originally, an independent journalist who has more information available on her Twitter and her Substack as well. So we have a little bit of information about that, but just to be clear, as I said in the intro to the story, that is not this force, this Trump force that's gone in. That's the NYPD in plain clothes, snatching 18-year-old Nikki Stone and dragging her away in a Kia.
Yeah, this is, it really underscores like just how hollow the New York City government and the response to these uprisings has been. Like they painted Black Lives Matter on the street outside of Trump Hotel or Trump Tower, and de Blasio had tweeted like, what's happening in Portland will never happen here. Here it is. What are you going to do about it? I don't know what else to say, like what to make people care. I mean, we've got jackbooted thugs throwing people into unmarked vans. Is that a society you want to live in? Like, we live in a police state and people are just like making justifications for it. Like, oh, well, she might have damaged property. Like, maybe you could just respond a little bit differently than abruptly grabbing someone off the street and throwing him into an unmarked vehicle. You have no idea what's going on. And what I'm hearing and what I've heard from people on the ground in Portland, what's happening there is people are denied due process. They're having their phones taken away from them, never given them back. They're snooping through their personal information, their contacts to develop like networks and to see who they talk to. This is extremely shady in the deployment, which we could see later in other cities, the deployment of DHS and ICE and BORTAC. Extremely dangerous threats to our freedom and liberty and a right to assemble.
Yeah. And by the way, like you said their, you know, is this the country you want to live in? Is this what you want to see? Hold on to that thought, because we have someone who very much does like to see this, and that is the country they want to live in, which we'll be playing in just a little bit. Someone very much on the opposite side of things is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who tweeted out that video saying, our civil liberties are on brink. This is not a drill. There is no excuse for snatching women off the street and throwing them into unmarked vans. To not protect our rights is to give them away. It is our responsibility to resist authoritarianism. And that's the thing. Again, this is just the NYPD that apparently has seen what Trump's people are doing and have probably rightfully come to the conclusion, we can get away with it. No one's going to stop us. We can just start to do that. And so they say in a statement that she was wanted for damaging police cameras during 5 separate criminal incidents in and around City Hall Park. We'll see if that ends up being remotely true. They said in their statement, when officers from the warrant squad took the woman into custody in a gray NYPD minivan this evening, they were assaulted with rocks and bottles. So two things in there. First, about the supposed assault. Clara Kraber, who was there, said none of that happened whatsoever. We literally turned the corner and were met with a line of police who attacked us without warning. Kraber said officers pepper sprayed the group, quote, seemingly at random during the arrest, adding they were trying to make it painful to be there. Another witness told Gothamist that the protesters had been skateboarding and eating pizza before the van's unexpected arrival. And you saw at the beginning of that video that Nikki was on a skateboard when she was grabbed by what hopefully ends up being cops, I guess, because there's now a precedent where theoretically 4 to 5 guys wearing vests can just drive around and snatch people away. And if you fight back, you better hope that it's not secretly police or something and not just some random person using the insane fascist environment that's cropped up in America to just start kidnapping people, because this certainly has become a great time to be a kidnapper.
Right. Yeah, absolutely horrifying. I mean, what's de Blasio doing? What is Cuomo doing? Like, I'm sick and tired of this vote blue, no matter who. I can't even say what I want to say, but I'm tired of this vote blue, no matter who, because here you go. This is the end result. You have a Democratic mayor with a Democratic governor. What are they doing in response? I'm tired. Painting Black Lives Matter on the street in front of Trump Tower isn't going to solve the problem. It's absolute garbage.
Yeah. It is garbage. And by the way, the NYPD can say, oh, it was a gray NYPD minivan. It was a Kia. That's all it was. It was a car. Yeah. It was a car. Okay, put a cop in my car and it's a maroon NYPD Scion. No, it's somebody's car. It's not a police car. It's not a police minivan. It's just some car. And again, if they can do it, then theoretically, some crazies like militia members and Boogaloo Boys and the white supremacists who have been infiltrating these protests to try to cause damage. We found out that umbrella guy was, in fact, a white supremacist. That shocked a lot of people. What if they start doing this? They could pull up in a minivan, drag away a protester, and they won't fight back, because we've now been trained that these are just cops. These are just Trump's goons, whatever. They're, you know, mercenaries or something. And that's what worries me, and it sounds like it worries you, Jordan. Doesn't worry everybody, though, because when Chris Hayes tweeted out that video saying, this is kidnapping, Ted Cruz responded, odd term for an arrest. And look, Ted Cruz is obviously the senator in this story, but Chris Hayes' tweet had any number of replies that were just, oh, what did she do beforehand? This is just an arrest. Why are you fighting back against the cops? So to your question earlier, is this the country we want to see? We need to remind ourselves that there's a lot of people that this is exactly the country they'd like to see. They're not scared of fascism because they believe, probably falsely, but whatever, that it won't actually come to hurt them, just the people that they hate.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if, like, a Unite the Right person or an Unite the Right attendant was thrown in an unmarked vehicle. What Ted Cruz's reaction would be.
Mm-hmm.
I'd wager that he would say, oh, well, I might not agree with their worldview. We shouldn't have this. Well, now that it's happening to one of his political enemies, he doesn't care. And it really shows how hollow this posturing is from the right around, like, liberty and freedom and assembly and all this kind of stuff. They want to be constitutionalists and originalists when it's convenient for them. When it happens to political enemies, they don't care.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember exactly who tweeted, but there was a tweet to the effect of, if that van had pulled up and the cops had just taken people's AR-15s away, the right would be losing their minds. But when it's a human, they don't care, so long as they have been trained to believe that's probably a leftist or something. Or at least somebody you don't have to worry about. They're probably just a terrorist. They're Antifa. You know, I want to quickly read a section. Cody Johnston posted a section from a book, and I just want to read a little bit just to give people something to think about. Fascist violence was neither random nor indiscriminate. It carried a well-calculated set of coded messages that communist violence was rising, that the democratic state was responding to it ineptly, think about Trump's quotes about democratic mayors, and that only the fascists were tough enough to save the nation from anti-national terrorists. An essential step in the fascist march to acceptance and power was to persuade law and order conservatives and members of the middle class to tolerate fascist violence as a harsh necessity in the face of left provocation. It helped, of course, that many ordinary citizens never feared fascist violence against themselves because they were reassured that it was reserved for national enemies and terrorists who deserved it. Every part of that is playing out right now, from Tucker Carlson labeling Antifa, everybody involved in the protests, as a terrorist that should be frog marched away. He's been doing that for literally months now. Everything Trump says about we need to go in if the Democratic mayors aren't going to save things, we need to go in. To people responding to people like Chris Hayes saying, well, you know, it's just they shouldn't be breaking the law. You know, if they're going to be, if they don't want to be brutalized, they shouldn't break the law. We're seeing all of it play out. It's sad. Anyway, yeah, we should be able to learn from the past, from other people, other countries that had horrific experiences with this, that had to suffer for countless years, countless lives lost. We could learn from that, but unfortunately, people like Ted Cruz are always going to be there to lick the boot, you know, and tell you to just lay down and have it placed on your neck. Big news for the military. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is going to be doing a little bit of curtailing of your recruitment, introducing a pair of amendments to a defense appropriations bill that would bar the military from using funding to maintain a recruiting presence in U.S. schools or on digital streaming platforms such as Twitch. Accompanying those, she said, whether through recruitment stations in their lunchrooms or now through esports teams, children in low-income communities are persistently targeted for enlistment. In many public high schools where military recruiters have a daily presence, there is not even a counselor. As a result, the military stops feeling like a choice and starts feeling like the only option for many young, low-income Americans. And that is, of course, why they set up in these schools in these particular areas, knowing that those are people that they're probably going to be able to snag. Now, Jordan, we talked about this topic a couple of weeks ago. Like, am I crazy, or is this not a direct result of you engaging with Army Esports on Twitch? Walk us through it. What happened?
It's been quite a couple of weeks. Yeah, it started with the Peace in the Nation. I'm grateful that they heard me out and understood the importance of writing about this. And in that piece, I detailed the shady giveaways, the fake giveaways, the recruiting tactics employed by the Army and the Navy on Twitch. Immediately, the next day, Twitch responded and said the Army has to shut down these giveaways. They're scammy. They don't follow guidelines. You're out of TOS. Okay. Mm-hmm. That was great. But this kicked off like a larger round of reporting on the Army esports team and the Navy esports team and how they were lying to viewers about their objectives, saying, oh, we're not here to recruit. We're just here because we love video games, and how they were admitting on stream that they were blocking terms like war crime and Eddie Gallagher in the chat, and blocking users who were asking about these things. And that led to the night. First Amendment Center at Columbia University sending a demand letter to the Army and the Navy saying, no, you can't do this. This is against the law. This is against this violates the First Amendment. So they are representing me and potentially more users who were blocked for pointing out the history of U.S. war crimes and mentioning people like Eddie Gallagher. And then it really took off when AOC took notice and introduced this amendment. And just yesterday in the House Rules Committee, they made an order, the amendment to remove funding or to prevent any funding for the military to recruit on Twitch or in esports, which is great. So we'll see. It goes to the floor of the House later this week. But from what I hear, it will be made in block, which is kind of how they just group amendments together for huge omnibus spending bills like this. Mm-hmm. And it should just pass with a voice vote. That's the expectation. So we'll see. I mean, tougher road ahead in the Senate, and then ultimately if it gets to Trump. But it's a great starting point, and I am floored that we're here.
Yeah, again, look, obviously there's great reporting in The Nation, and I know Vice did a story about it and all that, but, like, I feel like it really was kicked off by their ridiculous, heavy-handed reaction to what you had said originally. You are our Twitch warrior. Maybe that's your superhero. And by the way, I know you're really humble and everything, so you don't want to, like, claim credit or whatever, but I will say that you don't have to take it from me. My favorite reporter in the entire world said, Jordan tries his hand at reporting once and immediately has more policy impact than I've had my entire career as a journalist, LMAO. And that's Ken Klippenstein, and that's the Ken Klippenstein guarantee.
You can't argue with that.
Exactly. That's nice again. I mean, that's amazing. Like, I've tried to push for things, and sometimes those things have happened, but I know that the connection was not there, like trying to get Fox hosts to you know, tell people to wear masks and all that. But you, it was a quick turnaround too, a couple of weeks. So I only ask that you use your newfound powers wisely and responsibly. With great Twitch power comes great Twitch responsibility.
Okay. Okay. You have my word, John.
But anyway, and to AOC, you know, I'm so glad that, like, I have to think it's her that's doing this. She is younger. She gets gaming. She games. Like, would other representatives do this? Probably not. This is one of the good things about having someone that's younger and more reflective of the actual country. Like, yes, it's cute when she plays Animal Crossing, but it reflects that she is more like her actual constituents, and she gets those concerns, and now it's turning into legislation, which is awesome.
Yep.
Okay, Jordan. That was a big show. Really appreciate you joining us, you know, basically at the last minute and filling in for an awesome show. We always appreciate you having you here.
Of course. Thanks for having me, John.
And where can people see more of your work?
I'm on Twitter at Jordan Yule.
Awesome. Everybody go check him out on Twitter. Thank you as always, and have a good one, man. I am incredibly excited to welcome our next guest to the show, the Kentucky representative for the 43rd District, as well as the founder of Hood to the Holler, Charles Booker. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you, brother. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you here. You know, we like pretty much everyone, we're very closely watching that primary race where you came just within a couple points of a candidate that spent 40 times as much as you, I think it was. And, you know, obviously so close. But it looks like coming out of that race, you're not slowing down a step. You've got this new organization. Can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. And, you know, you're right. The race was tough. It was a tough loss. But, man, what we inspired, what we helped to ignite was so powerful. And I'm just really humbled. I'm proud. I'm excited. And, you know, we were making it clear, even during the primary, that this wasn't about even just beating Mitch McConnell. And it certainly wasn't about me. It was about us transforming our future and doing the real work, addressing structural issues. And this organization is really our chance to answer the call. After the election, folks were reaching out from all over Kentucky and honestly all over the country saying, we can't stop. You know, what do we do? We want to continue the work. Thank you for stepping up, but don't quit. And my response is, you know, this is about my survival. So quitting was never an option. And in fact, realizing that we created a platform for more people to have a voice. We turned out a lot of new voters. We inspired a lot of new organizers. People got involved in our campaign that had never been involved in politics ever. And we want to honor them. And in fact, we want to just bust the door open and create more space for regular folks to have a voice in leadership at the local, state, and federal level, and ultimately end generational poverty. And so Hood to the Holler is our rallying cry. And it's our declaration that we're standing together as family. We're gonna bust up the racist divides. We're gonna tell a new story, a new Southern strategy, and I'm fired up about it.
Yeah, that's actually what I wanna ask you about next. So obviously terming it the new Southern strategy, you know, for people who follow American politics and political history, the Southern strategy you're very familiar with. So tell me a little bit about sort of reclaiming that term, and what will it look like in practice?
Absolutely. Well, you know, our campaign really helped to shine a light on what it can look like in function. I ran a campaign that was on issues that a lot of people said, oh, those are way too progressive for Kentucky. And my response is, well, you don't know much about the people of Kentucky then, because when you sit down and talk to folks and you lead in with love and not hate and division, you listen to folks, you find those common bonds, and you tell the story about how issues really affect people and not just go into your partisan corner, you can build new big coalitions. And we understand that the history of politics in Kentucky and certainly in the South, but also across the country, was fueled by these divides that were fostered through racism that made certain communities think that we were different and created this dynamic where folks in Eastern Kentucky feel like they're on a whole different planet from people in the West End in the hood where I'm from. And for me, working across Kentucky and seeing the fact that we share so many common bonds and we're fighting so many of the same battles, we were able to lean in and talk about issues from a personal place. And so that's really what we mean when we're saying a new Southern strategy. We're not going to run away from our progressive values. We're not going to run away from the bold declarations that we're calling for change, for structural change. We're not going to ignore structural and racism and gross inequity. We're not going to ignore poverty. And in fact, we're going to talk about it. And we're going to talk about it from the fact that we're in it together. And we're going to call out the common enemy, which are politicians that could care less whether we live or die, corporations that profit from our pain. And you know, it's not a partisan thing. And I love the fact that we're being able to tell a new story, which is really what this is all about.
You know, if I had to guess, I have very limited experience in Kentucky. I think I've been there on one trip, basically. And I know, you know, as we say on TYT all the time, that these progressive policies are not radical. They are the mainstream. That's what people support. The politicians just don't accept that. But I would have probably guessed that Kentucky would have been a little bit less in that direction. And yet you, again, not running in any way from your progressive values, did extremely well in this primary. I'm wondering if you think, and maybe Hood of the Holler will be a part of this, that will demonstrate that this can be a winning strategy and that you might have more challengers like yourself in either in Kentucky or in other states like it running on a similar sort of platform.
Absolutely, and man, that's the goal. We want to create a new wave of citizen lobbyists. We want to empower folks, give them the tools, equip them to be leaders and run for office at the local, state, and federal level. I'm essentially going to pour out all the tricks of the trade that I've learned as a young black man working in every level of government, youngest black state legislator in Kentucky since the first one. I'm in a lot of rooms where no one looks like me, and we're going to change that. And the way we do that is really how we were able to effectively run a campaign against, you know, some of the most money raised in history as it relates to a primary. We did relational organizing. We went to the places that people forget about and ignore, and we told the story and we listened to them and we elevated their voices. So we can talk about things like a Green New Deal in Eastern Kentucky in coal country because we listen to people and we understand that when they lose their livelihoods, they just don't want to be thrown off the cliff. And in fact, if we address sustainable energy, we address clean water, we address creating more jobs and investing in infrastructure so that you're not being killed by the air or being made sick by the soil or the water that you're putting on your body, that is actually good for your future. And when we talk about that, folks are like, yeah, I want a Green New Deal. I don't know what they were telling me, but I want that. That's how we can address our politics. And you know, we built a big machine against a lot of odds and against a lot of money with a lot of folks that were organizing their families. They were organizing their groups. We used our faith, our conviction. We told our story. I've rationed my own insulin as a type 1 diabetic. I've nearly died from it. And we inspired a lot of people to speak up and speak out in the protesting that you see, not only in Kentucky, but across the country, is a sign that people are ready for something different because we know if we stay home, we can get killed in our home. And so we're standing up now, and Hood to the Holler is a way to say, okay, you're fired up, but this is how you activate your power personally and collectively and across racial divides. And this is a big deal, and I know it will transcend across the country.
You mentioned earlier that we have these politicians that don't care if we live or die. And it really seems that we're seeing that on a daily basis in the two crises that we're facing, the pandemic and the authoritarian response to the civil rights protests that have been going on for literally months. And as you pointed out, they've been going on in Kentucky. I know, you know, we've seen what's happened in Portland, and that now that's spreading to other cities. William Barr, in his testimony over the past 48 hours or so, has been completely unapologetic about it. And I know I saw that you tweeted about how he shouldn't be in that position. If that sort of tactic comes to Kentucky, if you see Trump's group of guys in camo basically in the cities of Kentucky, what should we do? What can we do at this point?
You know, I believe that the energy and the excitement around our organization, but just in general, means that we're going to have a big coalition of folks that are ready to fight back against that type of authoritarian approach. We know that our democracy is at stake. We know our future is at stake. We see institutional and structural racism that is permeating through these types of approaches, where our law enforcement is militarized and they see us as enemy combatants. And that's why the protesting has not stopped. That's why you're seeing people of all backgrounds in the streets still. And you know, should they send their secret police, you're gonna see me on the front lines like I've been. I think this is a moment where we put pressure on our local and state officials to be mindful of this and not let this fall into a blind spot. There is no degree of public safety that will come from having these additional officers in our towns, in our cities, disrespecting our constitutional rights and essentially escalating a lot of pain and tension that is justified. So instead of ignoring people, be accountable and be responsive. And we're raising our voices collectively to demand that, which is why we were able to get no-knock warrants banned in Louisville through the Metro Council unanimously. And so folks are ready to fight back. And what I'm telling everyone is, don't sit down, don't be quiet. Let's rise up together and demand the future we want.
You know, I have one more question, a follow-up to that, because as you point out, Louisville was successful in pushing through some reform already, thanks to the protests. And we've seen in other cities and in some states, some reforms. What we haven't really seen at the federal level is any real change or even an acknowledgement that anything is on the table. That, like, it's not like Trump and Barr saying, you know what, we've heard the concerns. You know, we don't like the violence, but we understand the need for reform. And so here's the debate that we're gonna have. There's been absolutely none of that from the federal government. And many people are worried that that's because this is a convenient election ploy to crack down on these cities as a sort of authoritarian show of force to get his base riled up. So as you said, you know, you've been involved in this. You're talking about being on the front lines. If it comes to your state, is there, do you have hope for any federal changes pre-election if Trump sees this as something that's beneficial to him?
You know, I have to say that I realize that the road ahead is gonna be difficult. And we do have someone in the office of the presidency that would use every tactic, explore and exploit hate at every turn. And if he's going down, he's gonna do everything to take the country down with him. That is very clear. So it won't be easy. But the hope I have is in the people that I see standing up that see through this BS. We realize what's going on and we understand that this is a moment that we cannot allow silence or complacency to win, because that means that we're gonna lose generations, if not more. We know that democracy is fragile and clearly we haven't perfected it in the least. And I think people are active now. Mainly the pandemic has helped people see the challenges up close, I think, a little bit more. See some of the things that I've been crying out and communities like mine have been crying out for years about. And so they're activated. And that's really why I wanted to launch this organization, because I want us to keep building that collective power. Politics and policies change because we change them. If we wait for those big corporations, big money interests to see us and hear us, we're gonna be dead by then. And we're not allowing that, man. And so my hope is in the people, and I know we're ready to fight.
And if someone watching this wants to get involved in the organization or find out more, where can they do that?
Absolutely, go to hoodtotheholler.org. Proud of this, man. We're building bridges, breaking barriers. We're gonna be training new leaders. We're gonna be building new citizen lobbyists. We're gonna be registering, re-enfranchising voters, focusing on former felons. We're gonna break down the barriers to democracy. We're gonna kick the door in so more regular people can be heard. And we will end poverty together. Hoodtotheholler.org, join us.
Awesome. Charles Booker, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Always. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.